Today's call to order. It's 1:10. We have a quorum to conduct business and others that will be trickling in. Present for the record are Representatives Gruenberg, Anderson, Dahlstrom, and myself, McGuire. We have a full agenda. We have four items today, and they'll go in this order. House Bill number 155, Use of Criminal Fines for Youth Courts by Representative Samuels. House Bill 132, Crimes Against the Elderly by Representative Stoltz. House Bill number 107, Attorney Fees, Hunting, Fishing, Interference by Representative Ramros. And finally, House Bill number 131, Access Device and ID Document Crimes by Representative Stoltz. And so, without further ado, we will have House Bill number 155. Ms. Nielsen.
Hello. Members of the committee, I'm Sarah Nielsen, staff to Representative Samuels, presenting House Bill 155. This bill is actually really just an accounting bill. It simply gives the legislature the authority to appropriate up to 25% of the fines collected by the Alaska court system to the youth courts. Most of you probably know what the youth courts do, but they're a really good program that helps young offenders by intervening early to set them on the right track and work to deter them from becoming adult offenders. In Alaska, the Anchorage Youth Court is the oldest of the programs, and in the
Sarah, can you speak up
just
a little bit?
Yep.
Just a little bit.
In Alaska, the Anchorage Youth Court is the oldest of the programs, and in the first two quarters of the current fiscal year, there have been 471 youth offenders referred to these programs, and that resulted in 8,833 hours of community service. House Bill 155 simply provides an accounting mechanism for the legislature to give these courts money. It doesn't stipulate that the legislature must do so. A CS has been drafted to address some of the concerns that the court system has, but the sponsor has no problem with a new version of the bill.
Okay, and thank you for that, Ms. Nielsen. It does need adopting. Representative Anderson, can I have a motion,
yes,
please?
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt for discussion purposes CS for House Bill 155. Version G.
Is there any objection to adopting version G, the new CS, for 155?
Could I've got to object for the purpose of discussion.
Hey, Representative Gruenberg, speaking to your objection.
What is the difference between the two versions?
Ms. Nielsen?
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I think I'll have Doug Wolliver of the court system explain some of the, it has to do with our estimations on the collection of the fines.
Oh, I see. It's sections 3 and 4 that are added. Okay.
There's also an email in your bill packet explaining.
Okay, there's an email in the bill packet, and we'll have Mr. Wolliver explain. Thank you, Ms. Nielsen. Doug Wolliver, welcome.
Thank
we
you,
don't
Madam
see enough
Chair.
Of you.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Doug Wolliver. I'm the administrative attorney for the Alaska court system. The reason for the CS is that the court system's computer systems, we're in the process of adopting a new computer system. It's in place in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Palmer. And over the next few years, we'll be implementing it in all the rest of the courts. But in those courts that aren't Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Palmer, we can't distinguish, we can't break out our fines from our forfeiture category in our accounting system. It's one lump sum. So what this bill, what the amended version does, is just allow us to give you an estimate each year. We can be very, very close to the total fine amount, but we can't give you an exact fine amount. So this allows us to make an estimate, which is what we do for surcharges already.
Does that answer your question, Representative Gruenberg?
Yes.
Do you maintain your objection to the adoption of the CS?
No.
Okay. The objection removed. We have CS for House Bill number 155 before us. Is there anything else you wanted to add?
Nothing specifically. And as you know, the court doesn't support or oppose individual bills, but I can say that as a general matter, the court is very supportive of youth courts, and you can do what you wish with this bill, but as a general matter, the court is a big champion of youth courts. I think they're very worthwhile on a number of levels.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Wolliver? Okay, hearing none, thank you. Now, I have got 8 people on this particular bill. And so this mostly goes out to those people online. I will call on you, and it's okay if you want to testify for a half hour each or even 5 minutes each, but I think you have the support for the bill from this committee. So If you wanted to use your time wisely, perhaps I could call on one of you in each of the LIOs, and you could give a synopsis of why your particular group there supports it. Be thinking about that. So, Jonathan Lack in Anchorage. Jonathan, are you there?
I am. Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you scheduling this bill so quickly, and I certainly appreciate your co-sponsorship and the co-sponsorship of Representative Manderson. I am a member of the Anchorage Youth Corps Board of Directors, and I also serve on the State Juvenile Justice Advisory Commission. On my own, want to say that Anchorage Youth Corps and the youth corps throughout the state are really remarkable. They are, like Ms. Nielsen indicated in her opening statement, really active in not only producing young people who are involved in the program and in training them to take an active role in the community. It's also a great way for first-time juvenile offenders to really be punished rather severely and very quickly. These kids are being arrested or detained, and then within 2 weeks, they're starting to serve their sentence. And for a first-time juvenile offender, that is really important. If these kids were going through the regular system, it would be months before they ever saw any sort of consequences for their actions. I did want to also indicate that this bill is strictly an accounting bill. I understand that a fiscal note had come out from the division, and that fiscal note would only be if actually the legislature did do the appropriation. So there should be a zero fiscal note for this bill, and it does leave it to the discretion of the legislature to do the appropriation every year. But it would allow the youth corps to have some reassurance that they are going to be funded every year, and it would also give us the reassurance that the state legislature today understands the importance of the youth court. So I'd encourage the committee to pass the bill, and I'd also encourage those of you who have not had the opportunity to co-sponsor the bill to get on before it's too late.
Fantastic. And Jonathan, being an expert in the political process yourself, you understand my point. We have four bills on the agenda today, and about 12 folks to testify in support of youth courts, and I understand that. However, is there anybody there that maybe disagrees or has a different perspective that could add something new in the Anchorage?
Mr. Earhart and Ms. Leon both are here to testify on behalf of the bill and support it, and they've given me the nod that they kind of agree with what I said and certainly appreciate your hearing the bill today. And unless there's questions, that they just would like to note their support, and we understand your time limitations, so thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. So in the Homer LIO, we have Whitney Cushing and Katie Gavinas.
That's right. We're going to consolidate our testimony.
Say it again.
We're going to consolidate our testimony for our sake,
thank
for your
you.
Sake.
I appreciate that.
Jenny Espinchade is here, too.
You're breaking up just a little bit there. If you can speak one more time.
Jenny Espinchade is here as well.
Okay.
And did you want me to test
that would,
right now?
That would be great. Try to pull the speakerphone as close to you as you can. We've been having troubles with the teleconferencing a little bit, so... and just state your name for the record, and we note that you are offering consolidated testimony.
Okay, my name is Whitney Cushing. Right, sound all right up there?
Yep.
All right.
Thank you.
I was a past student president of United Youth Corps of Alaska. Thanks for taking the time to look at our program. First off, I don't know if any group can be found of greater people, no group that can be found with a greater commitment to community and value of volunteerism. In my term as president and vice president, I've had the opportunity to work with students and directors from around the state. Simply put, the frugality and resolve to carry out justice can't be matched. Not only have the youth courts of Alaska been filling an integral part of the court system, saving state money, they have been saving us money in two profound ways. And as you're familiar with them, I'll just go through very quickly how they save the state money. One, since the money put into youth court is basically money to organize volunteers, it is far cheaper to send a student through youth court than it costs to send a student or student or juvenile through normal court. This eases the case burden on normal court, allowing them to attain their excellence in their service. Secondly, considering the far superior juvenile recidivism rates that youth court creates, sending a juvenile through youth court prevents future numbers going through the elastic court system, period. So per defendant, the youth courts are cheaper and chances are far greater that the defendant is never going to show up in our court systems again. Even in times of economic trouble, I believe it's necessary to invest in the courts. And I know that this isn't the bill that does. This is simply allowing the mechanisms that will allow future consideration. But I thank you guys today for taking a look at us and recognizing us as an integral part of the justice process in Alaska. Over thousands and thousands of hours are employed by youth court. Youth court is basically just the structure to employ volunteerism. So again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Whitney. I appreciate your testimony and the testimony that you offered on behalf of the others in the Homer LAO, and thank you for coming down to take time out of your day to testify. Okay, next we have in the Fairbanks LAO, Mark Huertes.
I'm here.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Mark Huertes. I currently chair the Fairbanks or the North Star Youth Court Board of Directors. I agree with everything that has come from Mattsu and out of Anchorage there. Our board of directors unanimously support HB 155. I think the only thing I can add is I've served or chaired on at least three major youth boards here in the Fairbanks area, that, and this is the only organization that the youth serve the youth or their communities, and not the opposite way around, where the communities are serving the youth. It is an exciting, exciting program to be part of, and I totally look for your support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, next I have Melissa McCombie in Valdez.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today. So many people have already said so many great things about you, so I'm just going to talk a little bit of my about, it is a little unique. We have a really neat situation here because our juvenile justice probation officer, Candy Connor, handles Cordova, Glen Allen, and Valdez. So any relief we're able to give her, she is greatly appreciative of. Just this last year, she's taken 41 referrals from the police department. 36% we were able to handle in youth court, which allows for her to focus more of her attention on the repeat offenders and felony cases. We're also unique because we accept city ordinance violations as well, such as minors in possession of alcohol, tobacco, and curfew violations. This is just such an immense program that helps out with our community. So far this year, we've donated 187 hours of community service and $377 in restitution to the victims. I could definitely go on, but I know you have a lot more people to get to advocate for youth court. I just want to say thank you so much for taking this into consideration.
Okay, thank you. Next, we have Patty Ware with the Division of Juvenile Justice, and you could testify a little longer if you wanted while I wait my two members coming back.
Madam Chair, I will go quickly for the record. Patty Ware, Director, Division of Juvenile Justice, Department of Health and Social Services. I won't repeat what's already been stated, although I will say for the record that Health and Social Services and DJJ are very strong supporters of youth courts. The woman who just testified talked about 36% of the referrals in the small office of Valdez. Statewide, in fiscal year 04, youth courts across the state handle 10% of the volume that comes to the Division of Juvenile Justice in terms of holding young people accountable through the use of their peers in this excellent program. Alaska's long been a leader, so I won't go on and repeat what's already been stated. One suggestion that I would like to propose for the committee's consideration in terms of the bill and the wording is that in Section 2, lines 11 and 12, where it talks about funding being distributed to youth courts either through the Department of Health and Social Services or the United Youth Courts of Alaska for distribution by that organization to youth courts established and operating. Our suggestion would be that rather than having the option of distribution either through the Department of Health and Social Services or United Youth Courts of Alaska, that the or United Youth Courts of Alaska portion be deleted. The rationale, and I wish that I had had a chance to testify first, because I certainly don't want to present that this is different than what we've been hearing from youth courts across the state. But this current fiscal year, we changed our funding mechanism. Normally, what we've done in the past is the department has issued subgrant awards from the department to the youth courts across the state. This current fiscal year, we did it differently, and we gave the entire chunk of funding to the United Youth Courts of Alaska for them to do the distribution and follow up and monitoring. We have received pretty much across the board feedback from the youth courts as well as United Youth Courts of Alaska that although they appreciated us trying that this fiscal year, they wanted to go back to how we've done it in the past. They don't have the infrastructure or the mechanisms to do that type of essentially accounting and grant oversight. And so in recognition of that, I would suggest to the committee that we may want to consider having it simply say, state to the department and not United Youth Courts of Alaska.
Okay. Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ware, if it goes through the department, will there be any additional indirect costs, or will the entire money go to the youth courts? If the thing that I'm concerned about is when we funnel money through the state, that often yields a layer of indirect costs.
Through the Chair, Representative Gruenberg, were the amount, we had submitted a small fiscal note to the former bill prior to the committee substitute based on the understanding that the funds would be appropriated. I now understand from the sponsor of the bill that necessarily isn't, that this isn't more of an accounting mechanism. So I think we put in for a half-time program coordinator position with a small fiscal note of $35,000 were those funds, and I believe it was approximately $890,000, to be appropriated. It's a fairly small fiscal note for us to support that level of programming and provision of technical assistance. I don't want to speak for the youth courts, but I believe that you would hear from them that they have appreciated the interaction between the Division of Juvenile Justice and our program staff in terms of their expertise, use of best practices, and that kind of thing. So it would be a small portion of funding.
May I follow up? How many youth courts are there?
14 in the state currently, with five that are in various stages of development.
Is that five additional?
Through the Chair, Representative Gruenberg, yes, in addition to the 14 existing.
Well, if there are 19 and this would be a one-time only administration of a grant?
Through the Chair, Representative Gruenberg, that is not the assumption that we used.
My question goes through the Chair. If you're just simply writing 19 checks once a year, is a half-time person necessary?
Through the Chair, Representative Gruenberg, we base that figure on an additional 35 to 40 youth courts based on a figure of about $900,000, based on the amount of money that would have been taken from the court system's fines collected.
I see. So this would be not for the current fiscal year, but in the future.
Correct.
Since we're looking at now an amendment to this CS, going back to where it was, I'm assuming you would be having some kind of, and I'm thinking at it in the platonic sense, a fiscal note out there that says 35. That's going to be, from what you've just said through the Chair, a future fiscal note. What would your fiscal note look like for the current fiscal year with 14 grantees with a possible five more?
Through the Chair, Representative Gruenberg, we would not have a fiscal note for the current fiscal year. In other words, Alaska has maintained youth courts for many, many years. We already have existing infrastructure to manage those programs.
Thank you. And I'll offer the amendment at the appropriate time if you wish.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions for Ms. Ware?
I do have, I'm sorry, I do.
Representative Gruenberg.
The reason I exited here and lost a quorum for a minute was one of your members, Seth, came by my office a couple of nights ago. We chatted at quite length, and he gave me two sheets of paper, which I have been diligently searching for, but I can't find. And my recollection, there were some legislative suggestions on those sheets relating to youth courts. and I'm kind of looking at Ms. Nelson here at the same time, because this is a very broad title, and I may offer a conceptual amendment to narrow the title. Since it relates to youth courts and relating to accounting for criminal fines, but if either we're going to narrow the title potentially, or I'm wondering, are there other things for youth courts that you're interested in that might fit under the title? I can't find those two sheets. Through the chair.
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, Seth Church is a member of the Alaska Juvenile Justice Advisory Committee. They did just have their meeting here in town over the last few days. And he did tell me that he met with you. We did not get suggestions that were specific for additional needs that Alaska's youth courts have that would need to go in a bill.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, with that, that brings a bill back before us. Representative Grunberg, you want to offer the First Amendment, the simple amendment?
I will. On page one, lines of the CS, the GCS, lines 11 and 12, I move we delete the comma and all following on line 11 and the words and through Alaska on line 12. So what we're deleting is comma or paren, two close paren, the United Youth Courts of Alaska. And I would offer that as amendment number one.
Okay. Is there any objection? Okay, hearing none, amendment number one carries. The title amendment. You want to do it?
I'll do a conceptual title amendment.
I'm leaving it drafted.
To Don Bullock, whom I consider a good drafter.
Okay.
They all are, but I think he's good. I would conceptually, with Ms. Tondini and Ms. Nielsen and everybody, just ask that it be appropriately narrowed so it just covers what's in the bill, and that's my conceptual amendment.
Okay, so there's a conceptual amendment to narrow the title down to just those things in the bill so that other things can't be added under the part that relates to accounting for criminal fines. Is there an objection to that conceptual motion and title resolution to follow? Okay, hearing none, that carries. Any further amendments or discussion on House Bill number 155? Okay, hearing none, I'd appreciate a motion. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I move CS for House Bill number 155, Judiciary Version G, as amended with individual fiscal notes, or individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Okay, is there any objection to that? Okay, hearing none, House Bill number 155 as amended moves. And thank you, Representative Guerra has joined us for the record, and Representative Anderson is excused for the record. For a bill up in another committee. So that brings us to House Bill number 132. And
yeah. Okay.
You want to come forward? We took public testimony last time, and we sort of left off with discussion about possible changes. So without further ado.
For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Representative Bill Stoltz. We did take the suggestions of the committee back with us and made some changes in the form of a CS you have before you. I also have Randy Raro from the Department of Law here to explain those changes because he's much better than I at this.
Okay.
For the record, my name is Randy Raro. I'm with the Department of Law. The changes in the CS, one of the concerns the committee had was about whether there was a Blakely issue, and we've done three things to try to clarify that there isn't. The first one is in the title, we deleted the word sentencing, so the title now reads an act relating to certain crimes. In section two, the location of the provision's been changed from Title 12 in sentencing and probation to Title 11, which is crimes or criminal law. And then in the language of the Section 2, we've tried to clarify that it's the crime and the penalty for the conviction of that crime that are increased. And I guess I can also state on the record that the intent of the Section 2 is that it would not create any likely issues. thought is that the defendant would get notice of the possible charging documents, and the case would be tried to the jury, or the issue would be tried in the beginning. So we hope that that satisfies the concerns of the committee on that issue. The other change is also in Section 2. It was in subparagraph B6. That the former subparagraph B6, which made criminal mischief part of the list of possible crimes that the penalty could be increased for, has been deleted, and the remaining subparagraphs renumbered. So we've went back and looked at that and made that change. I believe that's all the changes in the CS.
Representative Kira.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Rero, and actually I'd also I wanted to thank you. I wanted to thank Representative Stoltz's office too for working with me on the bill. I think the changes you made satisfy my concerns. So I'll co-sponsor it next time I get a chance. And also, Mr. Rero, I owe you an apology. The other day, I couldn't believe that the bill could have been interpreted the way you were interpreting it. As it turns out, I think you were right. So so I apologize, and I was wrong.
I'd like that section of the record marked.
Thank you.
Okay. And I did close public testimony, I believe, last time. We had the commission, or the bill before us in debate, and we were discussing possible amendments. So is there anything further that the committee wants to add or have the concerns? That we know from Representative Gira, his concerns have been satisfied. Representative Gruenberg.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned that you deleted subsection B6 on page 2, lines 24 and 25, criminal mischief in the third, fourth, or fifth degree. Thank you. I'm just wondering, I don't even remember what those were. I just got the book. What are they and why have they been deleted?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, they're mainly property-type crimes that we Representative Gera on some of his concerns that they're very minor-type crimes that probably frequently wouldn't involve an issue of reckless disregard for whether the victim was 65 or older. I think the hypothetical he described was simply someone simply keying a car, causing some damage. Chances are the person's not in the car at the time.
Anything further? And Representative Cocula has joined us for the record. Thank you, Representative Cocula. I know you had a legislative council meeting at the same time. Any further committee discussion? Hearing none, Representative Dahlstrom has a motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would move the CS for House Bill number 132 with attached zero physical note and individual recommendation.
First, let's adopt it.
I apologize.
That's okay. My bad. So, could you restate your motion, Representative
Yes,
Dahlstrom?
I move that we adopt the CS for House Bill 132.
Okay. Is there any objection to adopting that? Okay. Hearing none, we have House Bill 132 before us. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you. I would move that we pass CS for House Bill 132 with attached zero physical note and individual recommendations.
Is there any objection to that motion? Okay, hearing none. CS for House Bill number 132 with individual recommendations and attached zero physical notes is moved. Thank you very much. Okay. We're on a roll today, Representative Coghill. Okay, House Bill number 107, Mr. Pound.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Pound, staff to Representative Jay Ramos, who right now is in House Resources learning about controversial bills in front of your committee. Today, before us, we have House Bill 107. This is based on language in part written years ago about a growing concern that the legislature had of individuals and groups obstructing hunting, trapping, and even wildlife viewing in the state. When an obstruction takes place, there often is a criminal charge filed against the individual. They can also be sued by the aggrieved person. juries have awarded as much as $200,000 in some of these cases. But under the current system and current statute, reasonable attorney fees and costs are not awarded. This has a chilling effect, as those costs are directly passed on to the plaintiff in the case. An individual has to consider, before they go to court, how much it's going to cost to pursue a civil case, even if they prevail. HB 107 corrects this error in the law. It allows the court to authorize reasonable and actual attorney fees and costs to the prevailing party. It sends a clear message to those who would attempt to prevent people from enjoying their outdoor activities. It also tells Alaska's hunters, trappers, and wildlife viewers that we support them and their activities. And I urge your support for HB 107 and be glad to answer any questions.
And we have the resources CS properly before us. I don't see anybody else here to testify on this bill. Are there any questions for Mr. Pound? Anybody else? Representative Guerra?
HB 107, Madam Chair?
Yes.
Counsel, I just have this, explain this to me, and I'm not sure if it's a founded concern about the bill, but I just don't want us to pass a bill that has unintended consequences. And the bill says you can sue for full attorney's fees, which I guess could be a lot of money. If somebody obstructs your ability to fish or hunt, and it occurs to me that there are times when I'm fishing, if I'm fishing in a combat fishing area, for example, where people are obstructing each other's fishing all the time, sometimes rationally, sometimes completely irrationally. But I think the last thing I would want to see would be a lot of lawsuits coming out of a weekend at the Russian River. So why don't we think that one through?
To the chair. You might not, but as a lawyer, I might.
Frankly, it would be great for me to make money off of this. I'd like to be able to come home with some money if I'm not coming home with fish. But
through the chair, why I go to Funny River. But Representative Guerra, this same question came up previously, and it is my understanding that because the term lawful competitive practices, which is on page 2, line 8, that takes care of the problem as far as the question was worded in the previous committee. Well, you know, you have waders and I have hip boots, and so I can get out in front of you. And the fact that the response was the lawful competitive practices takes care of that becoming first of all, it can't be a criminal conviction, and second of all, it does not constitute the same because it is lawful for me to have waders and you to have hip boots.
Representative Guerra?
Just a few follow-ups.
You betcha.
I still have the concern because I don't think that what's going on sometimes is a competitive process. What's going on is somebody just being a jerk, right? They're not trying to compete with you. They're just cluelessly walking over your line or something like that. So I don't know that satisfies the concern. And frankly, if somebody wanted to work on that between now and when this gets to the floor, that would be fine with me too. But I'd also have a second concern, and this is, I'm also a trout fisherman, there are times where, when you fish for trout, this is going to bore the heck out of everybody, but it's what the bill does. So
it's far more interesting than what we usually have before us.
When you fish for trout, sometimes you try and keep a low profile, and you try and not splash through the water, and you try and sort of crouch a little bit so you don't scare the fish away. And then you still don't catch any fish, which is frustrating. But under the wording of the bill, it seems to me that somebody would interfere with my ability to do that by walking around splashing through the water because they're just not thinking what they're doing through. That's interfering with my ability to fish. That would annoy me, but I don't want to be able to sue the person. But does this now say that anybody who gets sort of hypersensitive about their stream ethics now can sue for full attorney's fees when somebody gets in their way of, now in this example, trout fishing?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra. The fact that we're dealing with a prevailing party clause, I think, would eliminate the frivolous lawsuits of that nature because a lot of the language that we're using here is already existing language within statute. So what we're dealing with primarily here is just adding the prevailing party clause to it, to the subsection. And I think primarily that we would not increase the number of lawsuits. The prevailing party originally was designed because of concerns in the commercial fishing industry, where they get into a very short opening and nets sometimes get too close to each other, but under the law. I mean, the only, as I said, through the chair, Representative, basically all we've added is the attorney fees.
Let me just make sure I have this straight. Are we on, are we in the resources version, the I version?
Chair, that's correct. Representative Garrett.
Yeah, I think what Representative Garrett is talking about is new subsection 3. Correct? You're talking about physically interfering or tampering with equipment?
Well,
at least that's one scenario that you were.
No, Madam Chair. See, it's the existing law. If you look at the existing law under Section 1, not the new amendment, but the existing law, it says you can't potentially hinder or obstruct essentially another person's fishing in a way that affects the behavior of fish, that would be scaring fish away, things like that. So it's the existing law, which isn't a problem today because if somebody wanted to sue about it, they get 20% of their attorney's fees, so who's going to do that? But now you're making it actually financially rewarding. You're making what was former conduct that nobody complained about financially rewarding because you can get all of your attorney's fees back. And so I wonder, it seems to me that an unintended consequence would be to make annoyances that people normally deal with now profitable to complain about. And your point is that you wouldn't be able to file frivolous lawsuits, and that's fine. That's not a frivolous lawsuit. I mean, under the law, if I'm trout fishing and somebody tries to scare the fish away, now it's a case that I can make some money off of. That's what I'm worried about.
I love it.
Through the chair, Representative McGarrett, I think I would look at it from a different perspective. You say that you're actually making a profit at it. I would think the attorney may be making a profit at it. But as the plaintiff, I'm still losing money, or I'm losing time, I'm losing various other things. All I'm asking for is my full reimbursement for probably a more egregious case of obstructing my ability to enjoy outdoor wildlife.
Somebody recently described our Judiciary Committee as Socratic, as a very nice way of saying we come up with all kinds of scenarios that no one would have ever thought of. I see what you're saying. I think you guys ought to continue the dialogue. Perhaps it could be a defense. Perhaps it could be there could be a way of looking at the mental intent. I'm not sure, but I see what you're getting at now, which is really the fundamental existing law right now, but the fact that we're changing it to make it more profitable. So, Representative Guerra.
Madam Chair, and I'm not trying to be flip about it. It's actually what the bill does. So, I'm not going to be flip about this. Fishermen are pretty serious about what they do, and I can tell you that people when they deal with sort of bad behavior on a fishing stream, it ruins their day, and they would sue somebody over it. I guess I would ask you to think about this. I'm not going to propose any amendments here, but it seems to me that if we made it, you get 80% of your attorney's fees, you get most of what you're trying to do with this bill, which is punish somebody for bad behavior, but you're not making it lucrative enough for somebody who's had a bad day then to go out and file a lawsuit, because then they'll have to still pay for part of their attorney. That's just a thought.
To the chair, from Garrett, we wouldn't have an objection to that. There's other language that I should add. It's been added in here that's actually become a more important part of the bill, which is the sections up in the 3 and 4 where the state has actually lost money because its language isn't an existing statute.
Mm-hmm.
In lawsuits. It's almost become the more important part of the bill as a result, trying to eliminate some of the lawsuits that state troopers and wildlife protection officers have had to put up with.
Just one final question.
Representative Guerra.
And we can talk about it before it hits the floor. I don't want to slow your bill down at all. I guess What's the strong motivation for the bill? I need to picture that better.
Through the chair, I was going to give primarily, most of ours has to do with trapping, in that we've had trap lines up in the interior cut. We have had animals released from traps that were already injured, that have been injured in the traps, and they ended up dying. And from the interiors, from the Fairbanks perspective, we're really looking at this more from the trapping side of it. We also have had some situations up there where people would get in the way of a moose or a caribou to keep somebody from shooting it.
Representative Guerra. Representative Coghill.
The trapping situations up in the interior come from a couple of things. The trapping trails have been traditionally just that. They've been harder to get to. But anymore, we have more and more multi-use going on. Somebody who actually brushed a trapping trail. And so people now have been going up doing skiing or ski-joring or things like that on somebody's trapping trap line and having trouble running into traps. And so what they've been doing is either springing traps or letting animals loose. And so there's been a tension between the various different uses of these. So that has been one of the problems. There are other trails where snow machines and skiers are running into serious problems, and they have put things that can be very damaging to machines as they have been typically going over these machines, and they've been maliciously putting things that have caused damage to people's machines. And so those types of things are happening as you begin to expand to do more and more multi-uses in these areas. And so I can understand why there's going to be some of these issues, because we are going to have damage issues, but then once the damage is done, the idea of trying to recover some of your time and effort of actually taking somebody to court is a huge issue. One of the troubles that I have with this, and maybe they've already answered it, so I'm just going to ask, I don't know how you can physically interfere or quantify, I guess you could say, physically interfering or tampering with viewing purposes. So I think we're going to have some trouble defining that, and I'd like to find out from the sponsor if they've thought how they would define that.
Yeah. One of the other issues, I think, too, is, I mean, you want to make sure the mental state is intentional. And that's something that I'm looking at as well. It does say intentionally obstruct or hinder, but then, and this is existing law, but then it sort of defines what that is. So by placing oneself in a location and so on, you might spend some time just looking at, I mean, what you want to get at is the kind of conduct. I mean, there'll be proof issues, obviously. And you're going to have to be able to prove that somebody put something in the way to harm somebody on the machine or intentionally interfered with the trap lines. But
sure, just to give you one example.
Yeah.
There are some people that may consider viewing viewing trees more pleasurable than viewing the skyline. So if I brush a trail, I may have just messed up somebody's view. And you know, and I think we need to consider what we're going to quantify in this viewing, because I think there are places, we actually had a lawsuit in the interior where one person built a house on the hill and another person bought property in front of them and built a four-story house in front of that. And a court actually ordered them to remove the top story of that house after it was completed because they obstructed a view that that person paid for in the property value. So,
really?
So it's, and I think we're going to, as we get into more and more multiple uses in Alaska, we better be really clear what we're talking about in viewing storehouse.
My goodness. And Representative Cott joined us some time ago. He had a legislative council meeting as well. We've raised more questions than we've. Representative Grunberg.
Madam Chair, I'm interested in that because the house we're renting is across the street from Breeze Inn, and they're thinking of putting a gas station there, and the owners are be concerned about that. But the other thing, my family, my wife Kayla, whom a lot of you know, is very active in getting dog parks in Anchorage. And the language of this state law could be read to prevent dog parks in a municipality, because like at University Lake, there are wildfowl there, and people use the trails and the dogs use the trails in a dog park situation. And this basically criminalizes them under existing law, and will subject them to actual attorney's fees and stuff. And I'd like to work with you on that, because that's certainly, I'm sure, not the intent.
Chair, Representative Greenberg, is not. I mean, the existing law was what we used as the vehicle, obviously, to make the changes. And as I said, the changes that we have in this 790 section of the bill were two items having to do with cases, actual case law.
And they're not at all related to this sort of a thing?
No, they're not related to the attorney fees at all, but it's actually designed to give the police a little more authority and to make sure that they're not inadvertently a subject of a suit, of which we
And I have no problem with that, Section 2 and that sort of a thing. But I don't want to see the folks who are doing the legitimate dog park activities or doing cross-country skiing or just walking like around University Lake. They might disturb a jackrabbit, which might be considered game or whatever, wildfowl.
This reminds me of the predatory fish bill.
Uh-oh. I'm scared what it's going to look like by the time it passes.
it'll look better. Oh,
and also I have a couple questions.
Representative Guerra and then Grover.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Mr. Pound. I'm sorry. But it appears this is what the bill does. I was just thinking this through. I know this sounds weird to anybody who doesn't fish a lot, so I apologize. But, you know, another thing that happens all the time is you're fishing on a river that a lot of people raft, and sort of somebody unthinkingly just rafts right over the water you were fishing, and those fish are then, if they're trout, they're gone for the rest of the day or the rest of the afternoon. People really get angry about that stuff like that. And this happens with motorboats on trout and salmon streams, too. And people really get angry about stuff like this. Like this weird group of people that I'm part of who fish a lot, we get angry about these things when real-world problems actually exist out there. Those are other issues that now they're covered by this bill, because the bill says you can't do that to somebody else. You can't do something that hinders somebody else's ability to fish. And these are now full attorney's fee cases, too. I think some of these cases are going to get filed.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think they could be filed under existing law. Since we brought it back to light.
Representative Grunberg and then Coghill.
Just a technical. Under court rules today, if you prevail, and that means even if you collect what are called nominal damages of a dollar, you would get your Rule 82 attorney's fees. But you'd also get your actual costs under Rule 79, the costs that are listed in Rule 79. Not every cost, but, I mean, you know, most of your legitimate costs. So I don't know how this bill would actually amend Rule 79. And is it your intent also to have actual costs and attorney's fees on appeal? That's the second question. Because if not, then it wouldn't amend Appellate Rule 508, which governs the award of attorney's fees on appeal, which are normally fairly a lot less than Rule 82. They're usually somewhere between $500 and $1,000. And if we do get into this detail, I mean, we're going to be working more on this bill. I want to talk to you about how these fee schedules work.
Representative Coghill.
I like the prevailing party side, and I like the law enforcement side. I really struggle with this, and I must confess, I'm just now beginning to see things, you know, that I didn't see last night when I was reading through this. So, and it, with no offense to the sponsor, it looks like we are including here licensed activity except for viewing, which is not a licensed activity. And I just wonder if that has any snags to it. You know, I'm just asking the question because I don't know how a judge would look at that. And so because we're asking about lawful activity, I think is how it starts off, right? Anyway, I don't know what I think about that, and I'm just raising that as a question that we're going to be asking a judge to look at the law that we pass out of here with some ability to quantify that, and until I feel comfortable with that, I'm going to struggle with that.
So, Mr. Brown, this is the last committee of referral for this bill. So that's one, and two, this is the committee that should properly work on these questions of mental estates and narrowing. It does appear, and I am sorry you have become saddled with the original law in the books, but you have, you took it on. You decided to add attorney's fees, and so that appears to be a lot of the subject of questions, too. So between now and Friday, if you can come up with something, that'd be great. If you cannot, then by next week, if you could spend some time working with members and their staff on some of the questions that arose today, and let's see if we can come up with a CS or some amendments that would make this bill a better bill, an even better bill. Representative Groenberg.
Just one other thing. I mean, Section 2 seemed to be the least controversial, least discussion this afternoon, but there's another section of AS 1605790. It's not set out in the bill. It's subsection D. In a prosecution under this section, it is an affirmative defense that the person was lawfully entitled to obstruct or hinder the hunting, fishing, trapping, or viewing of fish or game. That would seem to include law enforcement officers. So I'm wondering, since we already have that in the law, why do we need to have this new subsection 4 in subsection E?
Through the chair, Representative Groenberg, it may seem that way. The courts ruled to a $30,000 tab that a helicopter, a fish and wildlife helicopter observing commercial fishing was flying too low and therefore caused someone's set to have all the fish jump out of it. And of course, it was the biggest set this fisherman had ever had in his entire life, to the tune of $30,000, and that was just recently settled.
I'd have to see that opinion and find out whether it was ever appealed. We all the time in this committee get suggestions to change the law because a judge has made an erroneous decision. And that doesn't mean the law has to be changed. That's why, as Judge Moody used to say, the elevator goes to the fifth floor where the Supreme Court lives. We can't be changing a law that's already proper because somebody didn't bother to take an appeal, very frankly.
The chair, okay. They settled, so I suspect they're kind of...
Well, I still think it sounds to me like this current law covers it. Maybe what we need is a good legal opinion. Anyway, you and I can talk about that. That's
okay. Thank you for your time today, and please let Representative Graham Ross know that we mean no slight. And we look forward to his work and your work. So we will set House Bill number 107 to the side. And Representative Guerra, parting remarks.
Thank you. I just wanted to, if you could send my thanks along to Representative Ramros. I don't get to talk about fishing enough during the budget. It was fun.
Fantastic. Okay. I have been asked by Representative Stoltz to take a brief at ease in order to get witnesses. Everybody's here. Thank you. Okay, so that brings House Bill number 131 before us.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Representative Bill Stoltz. Access ID theft is a growing problem in Alaska and also nationwide. from 2002 to 2004, the number of complaints regarding access ID theft rose over 152%. In Alaska, we currently rank second in the number of complaints issued per 100,000 people. What House Bill 131 will do is increase the criminal classification of a theft of an access device, of the fraudulent use of an access device, and for fraudulently obtaining an access device or identification document. These stiffer penalties are meant as a step towards meaningful deterrence and punishment for these crimes. If the committee has any questions, I can try to answer those. We do have people online for testimony that are very busy, and I'd like to get to those if you could.
Okay. Why don't we do that? Can you stand by for questions that may, I would say, inevitably arise with this committee? Okay. Next, I'm going to go to, I'm just going to go down. Do you have an idea, Ben, of which of the folks have the strictest time constraints?
Just a second. I'm trying to think. Let me check who's online right now.
Okay. Dan Boone. Let's see here. Jay Foley?
Yeah.
Okay. So he's in San Diego. Okay. So Jay Foley in San Diego, California with the ID Theft Center. Are you there? Okay. So we will go to Dan Boone. Dan Boone on the phone here? No. Okay. Marie Darling? She's not here. Boy, we're going quickly. Sam Trivett? That's right. There you are. This is like calling out lottery numbers, huh?
Right. I-52.
Must be present to win.
Thank you. I'm members of the committee. My name is Sam Trivett. I'm here testifying as a volunteer on behalf of ARP today. I worked, some of you know, in corrections here in Alaska for over 32 years, and so most of my testimony comes from experience and also being somewhat involved with ARP's volunteer program, having been involved in some of the training programs here recently, and experience is pretty clear that law enforcement resources are stretched to the nth degree. I should also say that I've been a member of, I was the president of the Alaska Probation Parole Officers Association for many years, and I was on the national board of that group, also been a very active member of Alaska Peace Officers Association. So my experience and testimony comes from all these different directions. It's real clear that when times are stretched resources that if you have a crime that's a felony, it's going to get a lot more attention than a misdemeanor. As most of you know, a lot of times a misdemeanor just don't even get a phone call back from the police department simply because they don't have the time to do it. We had a couple of gentlemen from Juneau Police Department testify at one of our recent seminars here in Juneau on identity theft, and they testified about how complicated this situation is and how much the impact is upon seniors, especially who sometimes just don't understand the systems as they've changed over the years. And ARP supports this legislation because we think that by increasing the penalty for this crime, the chances are much more likely that the police will get involved and prosecute the crime. One of the things that the police officers talked about at our seminar in Juneau recently is that when they're dealing with another agency, and many of these ID theft crimes, you're dealing with people that are committing the crime in a different state. So you're having to deal with a local sheriff's office or local police department in some small town in the lower 48. If you don't have a felony crime, they frankly will essentially blow you off a lot of times. So I think this is a case where I personally don't normally support raising levels of crimes because they're expensive when you start putting people in jail for longer periods of time. I think this is one place where, having had some experience with my parents when they were alive in terms of theft of stuff from their house by some caregivers, that I think we need to send a strong message to the public that, in fact, we're going to use our best efforts and our strongest efforts to do the prosecution as a felony versus a misdemeanor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Trivett. Any questions? Thank you. Okay, I'm going to go to Michelle Logan with the Anchorage Police Department.
Okay, yes, this is Michelle Logan. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, Ms. Chairman, my name is Michelle Logan. I'm a detective in the Fraud Unit of the Anchorage Police Department. I've been with the Anchorage Police Department for over 10 years. The last 3 years I've worked as a detective in the Fraud Unit, specializing in all types of financial crimes, to include embezzlement and check fraud, hit money and documents, credit card fraud, and identity theft. And I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 131, and I thank you for this opportunity. In the past year and a half, I've seen a noticeable increase in our office in the number of identity theft reports that we've received. And these are cases that we actually have a specific individual perpetrator here in the state of Alaska with whom we get charged with a crime. A lot of cases sometimes are someone gets a blurb on their credit report, they have unknown suspects in another state, they handle their situation through many hours of work and find time to get their credit report back on track, but I'm increasingly seeing where people are trying to take the identity of somebody here in the state and crimes under that person's identity. Most of the identity theft that we see is credit card fraud. And although House Bill 131 is not specifically an ID theft bill, if it is passed, it will greatly enhance the efforts of law enforcement to combat ID theft. And it will also give the tools to put together a more meaningful case to send a prosecution. As we heard from the last witness, he talked about how police departments don't, I don't know that we blow off misdemeanor cases, we just don't have the resources. And I know here at the Anchorage Police Department, unless it is a felony, the detective division doesn't work. They don't even get referred to the detective division. And as a detective and an officer previously, the theft statutes and the access of use of the fraudulent use of an access device, two crimes for which I'm charging defendants. And I've also experienced the frustration of having a situation where their use of the credit card is only a misdemeanor. In one case, I had an individual charged her about 2 years ago. She was going into the local health clubs here in Anchorage, the Alaska Club, the YMCA, the World Gym, whichever club she could get a membership in, and she was breaking into the lockers. She was stealing wallets out of the lockers while the person was working out. And this person's still working out. It took them maybe 2 or 3 hours to realize that their wallet is gone and call on their credit card company and be able to report that they had shut down the credit card. In the meantime, she's had 2 to 3 hours to swipe every credit card in the wallet and rack up thousands of dollars of charges. However, each individual charge, by and large, was under $500. So here we were with a stack of misdemeanor charges on a very serious crime in which she was scheming to defraud many people. Another quick scenario that I'll give you is I'm working currently on a case with an elderly gentleman. He's a World War II veteran, 85 years old. He allowed a younger in that he was around in his 50s, a younger man to move into his house to help him with his daily activities once his wife died. And the elderly gentleman went out of town for 2 weeks to visit relatives in the lower 48. The gentleman who stayed in his home, the solicitation letters in the mail, which many of us get, even though we try to stop it, we continuously get solicitation to scratch credit cards. This man tried to or acquired 7 different credit cards in the elderly man's name. And so he obtained a fraudulent access device. He's racked up somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000, I think is what we've got right now. And these are each 7 counts of a misdemeanor. And so the egregiousness of the crime and arguing with misdemeanors. So I think if we do pass House Bill 131, it's going to send a message that, that Alaska is serious about protecting its citizens against ID theft, and it's also sending a message to the would-be perpetrators that we're serious about getting tough on this ever-increasing crime of identity theft. Thank you very much, unless there's any questions for me.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Logan, for your testimony. Wow, those are really sad cases. Thanks for the work that you do. Are there any questions? Okay, we do have Jay Foley on the line now with the ID Theft Center. Mr. Foley, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. I am co-executive director of the Identity Theft Resource Center, and we work one-on-one with victims of identity theft and assisting them in clearing their names, from the simple cases of credit card skimming and fraud to the most complicated criminal identity theft cases. Any and all enhancements, penalties in dealing with the subject of identity theft are a welcome relief. All too frequently, law enforcement agencies are taxed too greatly to pursue these cases, and when we are fortunate enough to pursue them, it is almost a mockery to the victim to have the court system go, it's a misdemeanor, it's a minor crime, it's probationary. We need tougher penalties on those rare cases when we can get somebody to stand in front of the court so we can make an impression on the prospective identity thieves out there. For the record book, I'm sure you've all seen the copies of our study that was released in 2003, The Aftermath. What it amounts to is victims of identity theft can expect, on average, spend about 600 hours of their life cleaning up the mess left by the thieves. This is talking to credit card companies, collection agencies, banks.
Yeah.
We could be talking to law enforcement officers and just dealing with the carnage that's left behind and trying to restore their good name and their good credit. Additionally, they can expect up to $1,400 out-of-pocket expenses. And even that is considered mild because we're not considering in there or factoring in there any form of legal fees. That is strictly out-of-pocket expenses prior to having to hire an attorney for assistance. Victims of identity theft suffer from wide-ranging emotional issues because of the betrayal, because of the feeling of lack of support, and they, to be perfectly candid with you, for the ones that I deal with in the state of Alaska, they're imploring your consideration on this bill. Are there any questions that I can answer, please?
Yes, Representative Guerra has a question.
I do have a question that's only tangentially related to the bill. It has to do with just something I've always had a question about and whether or not we should deal with it. Can you tell me, when somebody has their credit card stolen or their credit card information stolen, are there laws that prevent the cardholder from being held liable for any portion of what somebody else racks up on their credit card? Is there a chance that somebody who has their card stolen and their information used will end up on the hook for paying that debt?
Yes, sir. Start with, yes, there are laws. Under the Fair Credit Reporting Act and under federal law, they're only responsible for the first $50 in loss. But the caveat to that is that only applies if they report the theft promptly. If I steal your credit card today and I go out and run out $4,000 or $5,000 worth of charges and you don't notice it for beyond 60 days, then you're going to be held responsible for those $4,000 or $5,000 worth of charges. And credit card companies are going to fight you tooth and nail to make you pay.
And does federal law allow states the authority to regulate in that area, or are we preempted? Could a state pass a law that says the citizens of the state aren't on the hook for debts that are charged without their consent on their credit card?
I would suggest you speak with counsel of the Federal Trade Commission in regards to that. They are more expert on the Fair Credit Reporting Act restrictions, but I believe that you are preempted.
Thank you.
Yay. Thank you, Mr. Foley. Next, we have Steve Cleary with ACPERG.
Thanks, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Steve Cleary. I'm the Executive Director of ACPERG. I'm happy that Mr. Foley and Mr. Turkis of AARP have been on the line. They've pretty much summed up the great merits of this bill. I want to thank Representative Stoltz for introducing it. We've recently been trying to get more identity theft. We, being ACPERG, have recently tried to get more identity theft protections in the wake of the Choice Point security breach, in which nearly 150,000 consumers across the nation, which boils down to 251 here in Alaska, have had their sensitive personal information stolen, and that could lead to identity theft. Just came out in the LA Times today that this happened to the Choice Point company several years ago, and they never notified the people who were then victims of identity theft. So I'll leave it to the committee to decide whether or not this amendment, such as mandatory notification when that security breaches do happen, and something like a security freeze where consumers can protect their accounts, their credit accounts, by putting a freeze on them, that should be included in this bill, amended to this bill, or whether or not that should be addressed in separate legislation. I've heard from a number of senators and representatives, including members of this committee, interested in pursuing such reforms to further protect consumers, and we're really hopeful that that will happen. But I agree with the sponsor and those who have testified so far that this bill, HB 131, is a good first step in that direction. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Cleary. Okay, Linda Wilson with the Public Defender Agency.
Barely.
Can you
hear me?
Yeah, barely. A little bit louder, Linda.
Okay. Is that better?
Better.
Okay. Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Linda Wilson, Deputy Director of the Alaska Public Defender Agency. Thank you for giving us an opportunity to testify on House Bill 131. I certainly agree with some of the prior comments about the importance and the concerns over identity theft and credit card theft and use. And when I think of this, I think of the true identity and credit card theft, where we think of strangers or people coming in and taking on our identity. There are some worrisome things about this bill, however, that I wanted to comment on. And I'm sure they're probably unintended consequences, but I think they're worthy of noting. I worry about familial situations where you may have family members using or taking a parent, another family member's credit card or check. It wouldn't even have to be used, but the taking of it would now become a felony. If you have a parent who wants to turn the person in, or a family member that wants to turn the other family member in, you know, now we've got them faced with a felony. We also, if you look on page 2 of the bill, and again, I don't have the CS in front of me, if there is one, but in section 4, it discusses the crime of obtaining an access device or identification document by fraudulent means. And what is an identification document? That term is defined in AS 1181-900, subsection 30. And an identification document means a paper, instrument, or other article used to establish the identity of a person. It includes a social security card, a driver's license, non-driver's identification, birth certificate, passport, employee ID, or hunting or fishing license. So it could be something like an employee ID card, a college identification card. And what first came to my mind when I saw this is I'm going, oh my goodness, getting a fake ID. I think of young people who might be under the age of 21 who might get a fake ID. Now they're exposed to felony prosecution. Is that really what we want to do? So those were some things that I thought that might not have been considered that I thought were worthy of raising before the committee.
Thank you, Linda. And just so you know, we don't have a CS, so we have the original House Bill version G before us. Questions for Ms. Wilson? Okay. Representative Coghill?
Well, she brought up a good point. Actually, the point that I was thinking about is when you have domestic relations that are in tension, you might be fighting over a checkbook. I just wonder if that would fit into the description of the question that she was bringing up.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, I do think a check is a identification document.
I could ratchet
up. It's arguable that it is.
That might be an unintended consequence we don't want to use.
Yeah. Does Randy, do you want to speak to that?
Yeah.
Good.
I'm sorry. For the record, my name is Randy Ferraro. Through the chair, Representative Coghill. Could you repeat your question? I'm sorry.
If I have a family that is going through domestic problems, and one person goes off with a checkbook, and the other one charges them with obtaining an identification or a access device, maybe even if there is, for example, a restraining order. It's one more felony that we have to deal with in that domestic situation. And I'm just wondering if we're going to have a problem. I understand your intention here, but I'm looking for those places that, before she talked about other people using them, my first thought was, I guess I've counseled enough couples in tension to know that sometimes disputes over the checkbook or other sources of identification can be very intense.
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, you're absolutely correct in the regard that the issues in a domestic situation can get very emotional and tense. But as to the issue of the identity theft being charged with a felon, I think there's a couple things that intercede in there. The first is, of course, if it's a joint bank account, the person would have a right to have the checkbook. The second thing is that even if it wasn't a joint bank account and they didn't have the right to have the checkbook, the local law enforcement would have to agree to investigate and make the arrest. At that point, the prosecutor could exercise his or her discretion to charge at that felony level or at some lesser included level, which I've never been a prosecutor, but if that case came to me, I think I would definitely look at some lower, lesser included offense or not charging at all. So it is a valid concern, but I think the prosecutor's discretion will filter out a lot of those cases. And I guess even if it was charged as a felony, the jury, you still have several filters. The jury would have to convict at the felony level, not a lesser included offense. And the judge would have to sentence, the judge would still retain discretion to sentence, fashion a sentence that was appropriate. So I think there's several filters in there, but it is a valid, concern.
Representative Guerra?
Sure. I guess I've got some questions about the prosecutorial discretion. I mean, and leaving this to the side, I don't think we should pass laws that we hope prosecutors don't enforce. But that problem to the side, I'm not sure if a prosecutor have discretion. If the crime is now defined that if you steal somebody's identity access device, and let's say that's a check, and if that's a felony, I don't think a prosecutor could charge it as a misdemeanor. So,
through the chair,
you have to explain what you're doing to a judge before they accept.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think there's other criminal offenses that would cover the same situation, such as simple theft or some lesser, type offense. And I should probably defer to John Skidmore is a DA from Anchorage that deals in property crimes. I could probably defer to him. Might be the best thing to do, but I see what your concern is.
Madam Chair. He is online, Mr. Skidmore.
I would just share with the committee, and Mr. Skidmore can explain this further if we want. But when you propose a plea deal to a judge, the judge has to, even if it's a reduced deal, the judge has to say, does this deal make sense in light of what we know? And if the law says, if it involves a check, and this does involve a check, that it's a felony, I think it might be hard for a judge to ignore the fact that it involved a check and pretend it didn't and charge under a different theft crime. So I don't know that it would be so easy for a prosecutor in a family situation like this to not charge the crime that applies on its face. Maybe Mr. Skidmore would be able to help more.
Mr. Skidmore, are you following the discussion here in the Judiciary Committee? You answer any questions for us? Is he there? He's listed. How about Annie Carbonetti?
Madam Chair, I'll try calling Mr. Skidmore.
Okay. And then other than that, I don't have anybody else on my testimony list, okay?
My name is Annie Carbonetti, and I represent the Division of the Department of Law. And when I was prosecuting, we did have domestic-type cases, people wanting the prosecution to deal in a criminal matter, which with issues that were really domestic issues. And we have the authority not to prosecute at all in cases like that. And we did exercise that authority. Cases that were more appropriate dealt with in a civil matter, in a divorce matter. And I would say I'm not sure that a check is an identification device under this definition. I think a check is something that you can write that has commercial value, but it's not like a Social Security number or some other document that people use to establish identification. So those would be my two comments.
And for the members in your notebook that Vanessa prepared for you, this is just the definition section 1181-900. And so there are two places, obviously, that the definitions matter. For section three, it's an access device that we're talking about there, and that's defined as, you know, a card, credit card, code, plate, account number, algorithm, identification number, including a social security number, electronic serial number, or password that is capable of being used alone or in conjunction with other access devices or identification document to obtain property or services that could be used to initiate a transfer of property. So that's access device. And then in section four, which was the section that Linda Wilson posed her question about, that's where we're saying it's an access device or an identification document, where we're going to ratchet it up from an A misdemeanor to a C felony. And the definition that was read before, it's a paper, instrument, or other article used to establish the identity of a person. Includes a social security card, driver's license, non-driver's identification like a state ID card, birth certificate, passport, employee identification, or a hunting or fishing license. So that's that. Questions, Representative Guerra?
Chair, I think you satisfy half my concern. I mean, the prosecutors always have the discretion not to charge. But the other half of my concern is whether they'd have the discretion to charge, assuming that this is a crime, let's say it's a credit card and it's a family matter, along the lines Representative Coghill suggested. I think if we have a crime that addresses fraud by credit card and the facts are clearly there's a credit card and it was fraud, it might be hard for the prosecutor to charge it as something else. And so I think if we up the penalty, I understand that the prosecutor could just not charge, but I don't know that they're going to succeed in finding a misdemeanor to charge when we all know that it's really this felony crime we've created. You have any thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are this. Most of these cases are pled out. Very few do go to trial. And we have not had it. At least to my knowledge, and I checked before I came, we've not had any problems with negotiating pleas on property type crimes of this nature. And there are so many creative ways that people can reach what the prosecutor and the defense thinks is a just result. I don't think that we would have problems under these circumstances either. I mean, they're charged. You can bargain in terms of the number of charges and the proposed penalty. That I don't think it would be a concern. I would like to have John Skidmore address you, but from my experience and from what I've learned about this, I wouldn't be worried about getting a judge to agree to a bargain under these circumstances. I mean, judges generally tend to reject bargains in really the extreme cases of, and they don't tend to be property type cases. That's my experience. I don't know how helpful that is to you.
Representative Cargill.
Annie, what would it look like in trying to determine if somebody had actually obtained one of these devices? How would you have to go about determining that? Would it have to be, I would imagine, catch it on their computer if it was supposed to be in their possession, but how else would you, I'm trying to think of how obtaining becomes a felony.
Well, they can steal. I mean, I don't know whether you've had situations like that. I know my purse was stolen at a basketball game here in Juneau, and the credit cards were taken, and that would be one way to do just a trespass type taking. There was testimony about a person who got the mail of an elderly person and opened it and started using it. That would be examples. I don't know if I'm answering your question.
Representative Cargill and Mr. Skidmore's also.
And I understand, you know, kind of regular thievery, but I'm not really sure I understand high-tech thievery. For example, there are people who are willingly talked into things that there could be some argument that it wasn't deception, and I just wonder how far down that road we can go. You know, I get these continual emails that if I just give them my bank account number, yeah, they are going to solve a problem for me. Now, I know better than that, but and I guess that would be fraud and deception, and I think you could probably catch that. But there are some that are maybe that could make a case that they willingly gave it to me. And so I want to know, is that obtaining, how do we get to that fraud, or is it obtaining legally? You know, I mean, because if I give it to them willingly, how can you say that they obtained it illegally?
Through the chair, I would think it would depend a lot on what they told you that they were going to do with it if you gave it to them. But if Mr. Skidmore's on the line, he probably has a lot better examples than I do about how this happens.
Thanks, Annie. Okay, Mr. Skidmore, you're back on the line. There have been questions from the committee surrounding the definition of access device and the definition of identification document. There's a question about whether a check could be used as that. And then there were some questions surrounding what happens in the case of a family, or perhaps even in a case where you've got a domestic relationship, and obviously if they were on a joint account or so on, we understand that would not be, but let's say the relationship soured and these were the allegations, or maybe it's a teenage kid that steals your credit card. And Representative Guerra was saying there's discretion at the prosecutorial level, but what happens if you do decide to prosecute it? How could you or could you charge it for less than a felony if what the law is now is changing it to a Class C felony? Those are some of the things we're talking about.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me first by giving you a little background on who I am. My name is John Skidmore. I'm an assistant district attorney in Anchorage. I am the supervisor of the property unit, which means that I see any and every case that is referred to our office for prosecution that is a felony property offense. I've been in this unit for about 4 years now, and prior to serving in the property unit here in the Anchorage DA's office, I've been prosecuting on behalf of the Department of Law in Kenai, Bethel, Dillingham, places like that throughout the state of Alaska. Let me start with Representative Guerra's concerns about accepting the case for prosecution and resolving it at a lower level, the first and foremost that comes to my mind is the easiest way to reduce a felony to a misdemeanor is simply to make it an attempted crime as opposed to a crime. Whenever you have an attempted crime, that knocks it down by one level, thus making it a Class A misdemeanor. That's the first example that comes to my mind of a way in which you can resolve that. There are many other ways in which we can find other statutes that may not be the best fit for the crime, but in negotiating and resolving it, is very easy to slide into another level. I'll give you another example, and that would be the varying degrees of theft. While we could charge someone with a theft in the second degree if the value is over $500, if you're dealing with something under $500, it's easy to make it into a theft in the third or a theft in the fourth. And quite frankly, Madam Chair and distinguished members of the committee, I resolve many cases every single day that are over $500 as misdemeanors. We simply agree that the person is going to plead to a misdemeanor theft three, despite the fact that they've stolen more than $500. That's the real world discretion of a prosecutor that's used each and every day to handle those types of cases. Some of the other concerns that I heard were familial context, whether or not a family member might be properly prosecuted or improperly prosecuted for having taken a check. Let me first start with the check. A check is not in any way, shape, or form an identification document. When you look at the definition of an identification document under subsection 30 of Alaska Statute 1181-900, subsection D, what it says is a Social Security card, a driver's license, a non-driver's identification card, a birth certificate, a passport, an employee identification, hunting or fishing license. I can't imagine a situation in which I or any of you or any other member of our state were to walk in someplace and would use their personal check as a form of identification for themselves. That's not what this definition talks about. And with all due respect to Ms. Wilson, I don't think that that in any way, shape, or form would be an identification document. I think that that is an access device, and it's properly defined as an access device when you start looking at account numbers and the definition of an access device under subsection 1 of Alaska Statute 1181-900, subsection B. The access device talks about a card or a credit card, plate, code, account number, and that's where you're going to get the access devices because the check would contain your account number. But quite frankly, if someone improperly uses a check, the bill that's in front of you folks today is not in any way, shape, or form going to be addressing checks because quite frankly, checks are addressed by forgery. A check is a written instrument that when uttered or falsely altered or falsely completed is already a felony in the Class C range. And we prosecute those each and every day. When you want to talk about familial context, to come back to where we started, the familial context, we have children who steal their parents' checks, and often we use our discretion in terms of whether or not it's appropriate to be prosecuting someone for those particular crimes. One of the other things that you all have to keep in mind is the other language of the statute. When we are looking, let me turn to the appropriate statute, 1146, 290, obtaining an access device or identification document by fraudulent means, it says that when you obtain the document, you have to do so with the intent to defraud. So in the familial context, you would first of all have to be concerned with whether or not the child or the other family member had an intent to defraud the person from whom the access device or identification document belonged to begin with. So there are other elements that have to be taken into consideration. But quite frankly, I have to echo what I heard the Assistant Attorney General talk about earlier, and that is there is discretion, and it's built in multiple layers in the criminal justice system. You first have to have enough evidence for the police to want to move forward with something. They have discretion about whether or not to refer it to our office. Our office then uses discretion in terms of whether or not this is an appropriate case to charge and use the resources of the state to seek a criminal sanction against someone for the conduct they engaged in. And the checks and balances on our office and on the police, quite frankly, come from the jury system and the judges. So
I don't see there being those problems in the familial context. Many of those cases are indeed screened out, and we don't prosecute them. But when we do, it's because those cases are just as serious as all of the other theft cases that are out there. And there is an appropriate situation sometimes when children are stealing from their parents. We don't prosecute many of them, but we prosecute some of them. And the ones that are prosecuted are when the parents really think that there is a need, and sometimes it's because the child has a drug addiction. Well, we can't catch the child with the drugs, so instead we're able to charge them with another felony offense, put them on probation only, and make conditions of their probation that they get drug treatment. That's, in fact, precisely what the family wanted to begin with. So I don't have those concerns about the familial situation.
Representative Coghill?
Thank you, and that helps me. So those are some of my concerns. My struggle is, seems like, first of all, I agree with the intent of this bill, so I'm not going to, you know, hold it up, but I'm trying to find some comfort. Here we're going to have a Class C felony now for $50 or more, and it seems like we make it easier to become a felon, and there's a huge, huge effect on being a felon nowadays. But what I heard earlier, and maybe you can help me understand this a little better, is if they use, say, this access device for six $40 charges, is each one of those a different charge that you have to prosecute, or can it be added up? Because it seems to me that I heard earlier that there was several singular uses that didn't add up to make a felony. So how would you see that?
Through the chair, Representative Coghill, the statute that addresses that is statute 1146. I want to say it's 990, but let me turn there to make sure I get the proper citation for you. No, I'm sorry, it's 980, subsection C, and that statute talks about the determination of value or the aggregation of amounts. And what the statute says is that in determining the degree or classification of a crime under this chapter, amounts involving in criminal acts committed under one course of conduct, whether from the same person or several persons, shall be aggregated. So to answer your question, it would have to be shown that the multiple acts that had occurred were all in one course of conduct. And that's a very much fact-driven question. We do often aggregate those types of cases, but you have to have the appropriate facts that it was all in one course of conduct as opposed to several acts that were not in one course but were in multiple courses.
So, Madam Chair. And you talked about real-world prosecution, and I'm wondering, we're dropping this Class C felony from a $500 to starting at $50. That seems awful low to me, and I need to understand. I understand the seriousness of identity theft, but I struggle with the $50 level. So can you help me understand why a $50 level would qualify as a Class C felony under this condition?
Well, through the chair, I think the answer to that is that an identity theft is a much more insidious crime than a straight theft. Let me provide you with the most common example of theft in the city of Anchorage. A person walks into Walmart, Fred Meyer's, Kmart, one of the big box stores. They grab an item that's worth $500 or more, whether it's a piece of jewelry or perhaps they're loading up the cart with multiple items. They then try and exit the store without paying for those items. The most common form of theft that is seen in Anchorage. That person has committed a felony offense, but their offense has ended as soon as they are caught. That's done. There are no more repercussions for it. Whereas with identity theft, what I think you heard from some of the earlier folks who testified was that that's not the end for the victim. I heard a story recently on the radio where the person was telling folks, if you become the victim of identity theft, congratulations, you've just gotten a new part-time job. You will now spend countless hours trying to fix your credit history and protect yourself, dealing with creditors and other people. There are some folks that the emotional trauma they go through is tremendous. There was a case that we prosecuted up here about 3.5 years ago where the lady actually lived in Las Vegas, and the people stole her identity, came up here, and started buying things. She lost her job because she missed days at work trying to deal with her creditors. She lost promotion opportunities before that. She was in psychological counseling. It goes on and on. Now, I don't think that's necessarily going to happen for someone who's only been defrauded by $50 to $75. But when you ask me, why would you lower the limit? My response would be because identity theft is more insidious than most other types of crime. And for those reasons, maybe it's worthy of it.
And I appreciate that. And Madam Chair, I tend to agree that, generally speaking, because of, I think, the ongoing nature of it, I probably am not going to object, but it dips pretty low for me as far as a felony. And so the fraudulent part of that is going to be, to me, the only thing that keeps me there.
Understood. More committee discussion? Okay, thank you, Mr. Skidmore. So we have the bill back. Anybody else wants to testify? Any online that we can't see? Okay, so public testimony is closed. That brings the bill back before us for committee discussion. And I don't know what the wishes of the committee are.
I'd like to make a motion, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Dahlstrom.
I would move House Bill number 131, version G, with attached physical note and individual recommendation.
Is there an objection?
For purpose of discussion. Sorry,
okay.
I'm late. Yeah, I'm struggling with the $50 felony also. And I suppose I want to be polite and not hold this bill up and spend time writing an amendment when I haven't spoken to the sponsor of the bill. On the other hand, I don't know if there is another $50 felony on the books. You know, we spend a fair part of our week upping crimes to another level to deal with conduct that's bad conduct. But sometimes we hope that by doing that we're going to stop it, that we're going to send a message, but the people who do this stuff don't read the statutes, so it doesn't work that way.
You have another dollar figure in mind?
Not without shooting from the hip, I don't.
So... the bill, let's see, it goes on to, I guess, the Finance Committee next. It's kind of up to you.
I guess Mr. Skidmore, if he knows of another $50 felony?
I think what he can answer, but I don't think there is. I think what he testified to is the fact that why you would lower it outside of the normal theft in the second degree, which is $500 or more of property, is because of the insidious nature and the fact that it usually goes beyond that. But Mr. Skidmore, do you know of any other felonies that add up to $50?
He's no longer online.
Madam Chair, I think I could probably help answer that a little bit because I've actually started a bill that is looking at all the felony charges. So my expectation is to have one in front of this committee sometime before we adjourn. Not that I expect to get it out this year, but I want to ask some questions on the felony levels. But on this particular case, the difference between running off with your pen or sticking an IV into your vein probably is compelling, you know. So
a movie, wasn't there, the kid stole a loaf of bread or something out of, I think it's Alcatraz or something, but out of the store that was attached to the federal post office in the town, so it became a federal crime, became a felony, so there, maybe on the federal level, I'm not sure. So there's a motion on the table, there's an objection. Is there other committee discussion? Representative Cott?
I share some of the same concerns, Madam Chair, as members across from me share. You know, the argument that it's insidious and $50 is a good number. you could take that argument a little further and say, if that insidious, why not $10? I mean, yeah, you still have the same consequences. And I think Representative Coghill brought up that with $50 limit now, which creates a felony, there are a lot of consequences that come along with that $50 felony, a lot of privileges that you tend to lose. So I'm struggling with that amount as well. I would be more than happy to accommodate Representative Guerra if he made the motion to amend the bill to a greater number, but it's an arbitrary number.
Even 500 is. I mean, that's been on our statutes. It exists in the second degree theft and exists and is the number now, and how that number was arrived at. It's always difficult in these. You're kind of trying to get to the weight of the crime or the seriousness of it, but it's difficult in terms of a dollar amount.
Well, Madam Chair.
Representative Coghill.
Just in the spirit of discussion, the aggregated amount was something I was looking for. How do we understand a charge that goes up? Because I think if I understand correctly, most of the fraudulent uses of access devices probably are much more significant than $50, from what I've heard. And even in my own family, I've felt the sting of somebody working their way into an account where I had to close a MasterCard account of my own to protect myself. So. I got it before there was any major charges because somebody called me from Florida asking if I really wanted to buy $5,000 worth of phone cards. And I was very grateful that they called me. But somebody, that meant somebody had my number. And and $50 might have gone out of my account and I would may have never noticed it for the duration. So I'm sympathetic to it, but I also am very cautious that we create a situation where somebody on a $75 fluke can become a felon, may not be able to travel from Fairbanks to their capital by highway anymore, and I just don't know. And now I know that we're going to be going through a court system, and something like that probably wouldn't make it through the court system. But it is a very low threshold, and I guess I'm getting some comfort from the fact that it's a fraudulent use that has to be demonstrated before we get there. And that's the only comfort I'm taking from this. And so, if that ever gets misused in interpretation, then I have a serious problem.
Yeah, we're kind of running out of time. Ben, I was going to see if you wanted to try to make your pitch to the committee one more time, or if...
Yeah, I can do the closing, just to
okay.
Response to...
Maybe you can... You see what the committee appears to be struggling with is the dollar.
And through the chair, Representative Coghill, for an access device, you look at it like Mr. Skidmore gave an example of when you go into and you shoplift the item that's $500 and that's it. You steal an access device that, I mean, they may only use, let's say, $60 worth of it. But technically, you could have a $30,000 limit on your credit card. There's that potential. And second, as far as maybe an amendment, we would like some time maybe to discuss this and see through some other channels what would be an appropriate amount, if anything.
Representative Dahlstrom, would you consider withdrawing your motion to move the committee substitute, or pardon me, the original House bill out of committee today?
I would do that, and I'd like to make a comment.
Okay.
And I won't hold the bill up, but there is something I'd like to do some studying on. And I was saying last night, the more I read a couple of these bills, the more I saw, and then I circled that one last night in big red circle because I'm thinking, well, I just don't feel comfortable.
Yeah, and sometimes in this committee, getting a motion out there pushes people to the point of thinking about what it is they really feel, and so I wasn't getting a sense. So I asked Representative Dahlstrom to put it out there just to kind of get people thinking one way or the other. So, Representative Dahlstrom.
Madam Chair, and I'd like to put on record, I share a lot of the same concerns that have been brought up. You know, whether the number was $50, $100, $500, even $5,000 of the potential consequences, and to me, I call them natural consequences of one's actions. And the flip side of that is that if I am a victim of identity fraud, and luckily I haven't been, but potentially that could cause me to lose out on a real estate deal. Maybe the house of my dreams comes up for sale and they run a credit report and I fail it, and it's my duty, the burden is upon me to clear my record, and we all know how long that type of thing. It could cause me to lose a promotion at work, and it could cause me to not get certain jobs because I have to have a credit report done. It could cause me potentially, you know, all kinds of problems that will take a long time to clear up. I have had the experience of having someone else with my same name in a different state have their information show up on my credit report, and it took me over 2 years to get that off. And it wasn't even a huge number or even anything that was so derogatory that it kept me from obtaining or doing something I wanted to do. It was just the fact that it was wrong, incorrect information. And again, the burden was upon me. And so, you know, that's the other side of it. And I also put great weight in that, the wording of the fraudulent use. So, you know, we have a lot of food for thought here.
Well, those are great comments. I have had somebody, well, I mysteriously made $400 of phone calls to the Philippines about a year ago. And sadly, it was my debit card. And because it was my debit card, the contract with Visa is different. Mm-hmm. And so I spent, I think at least 2 months trying to reconcile that and get them to cover that. And in the end, I just gave up because I didn't have enough time in my day to continue working on it. And so I just wrote it off. And I'm sure there are a lot of people that end up doing that. But it is devastating. And there's a policy call here to make. But I think we've had some great discussion, and you know, that's what this is all about. Not all the bills are supposed to go through the way they are, and we've had a lot of thoughtful discussion. So I'll get to you guys, but just make sure that Representative Stoltz knows that you know, he's got a little work cut out for him, and department, in conjunction with Department of Law, perhaps looking at maybe what other states do. What are some of the dollar amounts that can be used as examples in Alaska, maybe other dollar amounts lower than $500 for which we place a felony. Those kinds of things would be helpful. Representative Guerra and then Gruenberg.
I think what makes it insidious is that somebody can keep using it, even if it's only $50, they keep doing it. But so I wonder if the way to fix it would be to say, to make, if somebody does repeated use of the credit card or the other access device, so that if they added up to more than $500, even if each one of them was a misdemeanor under the current law, because it's $50 or $75 or $150, and I'm wondering if you could explore the idea of aggregating them, and if they aggregate to more than $500, then that's a felony.
Representative Gruenberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have been the victim of thousands of dollars. They used my credit card in the Nordstrom's women's department.
It was not.
At least it wasn't hosiery.
In Costa Mesa. And a certain young man who we all know also tried to use my credit card to go visit a new girlfriend in Flint, Michigan. And he was prosecuted by the victim, me. So, you know, we dealt with both of those, and the credit card company absorbed the loss. And
he's checking my credit cards.
So, you know, and I'm wondering what other things are being done to protect the consumer here. when
pictures that, max pictures.
No, she changed. Well, what they did, they changed. They used my number and changed the name and the picture. These were sophisticated people. And it was good. La Brass Plum, is that the name of the place at Nordstrom? Yeah, that's what they used it. I said, Madame, I haven't used the Brass Plum in Nordstrom's this week. But I'm just wondering, you know, this is but one problem that people have with identity theft and increasing criminal penalties and stuff is a good idea. The question I had was, since they used my credit card in California, where was the crime committed? Because, you know, they could take the card and use it anywhere, even though it's my card in Alaska. They used it in another location. It obviously was committed in California, but that's just one other issue that came up. Representative Coghill and I have talked another aspect of this. Some of these credit card companies make it very hard for you to pay your bill on time. They do it so quickly, particularly in Alaska, that you cannot pay your credit card without having huge finance charges. And he had a bill in two sessions ago that didn't go anywhere, and then he didn't put it in last time. So I'm very interested in the whole subject.
Yeah, me too. Representative Gary, you should look at some of those, some of the elements of that bill that you had. Maybe Representative Stoltz would be amenable to having some of them incorporated.
You're talking about the civil issue?
Yeah, your fraud bill that you had. Sort of an omnibus fraud bill, wasn't it?
I'm not sure. Right now I'm working on a bill to deal with this choice point issue of the companies that know that your financial information has been stolen and they don't tell you about it.
I know there was one two years ago we heard, didn't we?
Didn't you have one last year?
I had a consumer bill that passed, so that's gone. Did I have another fraud bill?
I don't know, but let's go off the record. We're boring people. Okay, with that, we're adjourned.
That was a spam bill.
People all...